said that the competition won't last terribly much longer.
Thank you, Your Honour. The next witness for Dairy New Zealand Fonterra is Mr. Wright Stroke.
Do you solemnly, sincerely, and truthfully declare and affirm that the evidence you're about to give this court shall be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth?
Good afternoon, Mr. Wrightstow. Can you please confirm your full name is Aslan Edward Wrightstow?
It is.
And you're the Senior Manager Environment at Dairy New Zealand?
Correct.
And you've prepared one statement of evidence dated 28 July 2023. Yes. And you were also involved in the Farm Systems Expert Conferencing earlier September this year?
Correct.
And the qualifications and experience you have are set out in your statement of evidence? Do you have any corrections to make to your statement? Thank you. Can you confirm that your statement of evidence, therefore, is correct to the best of your knowledge and belief?
Yes.
Thank you. Can you please answer any questions from my friends in the court?
No questions, thank you, sir.
Yes, sir.
Good afternoon, Mr. Blackstone. I'm the lawyer for conservation, so thank you for your evidence. My question is for you around the good farming practices, aspects of the evidence. And so just to set some scene, I guess, in terms of your background, I note in the evidence that you hold a Bachelor of Science in Physiology, as well as a Master of Science, First Class Honours in Freshwater Ecology. However, you're the Farm Systems Expert for Dairy New Zealand in this case, or one of them?
To an extent. Yeah. Most of my work is related to freshwater farm plans and farm environment plans.
Yes.
To an extent applicable through that mechanism.
Yes. And I understand that you, prior to your current role, you had some 17 years with, as a principal technician at NIWA. Thank you. And so if I could take you through your evidence at paragraph 5.23, please. So in here, it talks about a sustainable land use initiative as another example of how whole farm planning is a focus on reducing sediment loss, and there are programs that have been reported with the following results. And then down in subparagraph B of that paragraph, it talks about best management practices were found to reduce phosphorus, E. coli, and sediment concentrations. And data indicated that extension advice and on-farm practice change have helped to improve water quality over time, all some but not all parameters. I just wanted to ask about the data indicated that extension advice and on-farm practice change. Are you able to expand on what you mean there?
So I'll talk primarily to the best management deer catchments study, which is in paragraph B, along 5.23. So I know that one more familiarly than number C. The work there aimed, obviously, to take a coordinated approach to supporting landowners to make change based on catchment context, based on the most pressing water quality issues, based on biophysicals. And what that work did is, over a 20-year period, supported landowners through one-on-one support and through targeted advice to make decisions that were most pressing for their farm in that wider catchment context. And what was reported through that and some of the other studies talk shortly to some of the farm evidence, and there was one of those that nicely demonstrated that, was the power of having that one advice, that power of having a collective working together towards a common approach. In Mr. McGibbon's evidence, there was, I think, Appendix 3 in that one there. And that was a piece of evaluation work under Momentum. And in that, what they reported through there was that that on-farm visit through a qualified advisor increased the understanding by almost 100%, so 96% was the numbers there. So collectively, that advice at the farm scale reporting back to drive better decision making.
Right, and so can you give an example of the type of support that's provided on a farm scale?
Yeah, so it's somebody who's qualified in management, somebody qualified in understanding farm systems, and someone qualified or experienced in understanding the environmental outcomes that land use has or farming practices have. So that's the sort of expertise fed into the farmer in combination with on farm visit generally, to understand, to walk the farm, to identify waterways and understand that broader catchment context, including, for example, sensitive receiving environments, current water quality condition, and bringing those things together to understand actions at the farm scale for driving broader outcomes at the catchment scale.
Right, thank you. So it's well supported then with advice around water quality through the work that you've been involved in.
Yeah, so it's water quality, it's broader ecosystem health, it's understanding contaminants, movement through the landscape, and also farm systems. And so with that, understanding options for mitigations in farm systems, or more broadly, what we describe as interceptive or edge-curve mitigations. So bringing that package together in an integrated way through sound understanding, conversations and discussions.
And I'd expect that type of support is well received by the farming community.
I did a Tiaki plan recently with a Fonterra Sustainable Dairy Advisor. And what struck me with that wasn't the pre-work that went into that site visit or that farm visit, nor the hour and a half where we sat at the around the dining table. It was the following 3 or 4 hours we were walking around the farm, we were understanding, we were putting those things into a context that the farmer really understood, and those discussions that play out as part of that kind of relaxed and formal way, underpinned by a really sound knowledge base and good scientific evidence.
And with the support, is there any cost to the farmer in receiving the support?
I think it depends. So, for example, if I talk to the Fonterra example, or if I talk to the Open Country Dairy example, both of those dairy companies have set up schemes where that advice is part of providing or being supplied to those companies. Similarly for Tatua, similarly for Midaka. I think from a dairy context, the vast majority of those dairy companies provide that advice and that support as part of the commission supply.
Thank you for that. And so moving down to CLO, you didn't know that you're not as familiar with subparagraph C there. But I just was picking up on the last sentence around the 570,000 metres of waterways were fenced. Are you able to talk to that at all? Or?
Not particularly. The study in that work was done a little while ago. I wasn't directly involved in that.
Okay.
my reference to that is from just reading some literature, one of the points here is that there's not a huge amount of longitudinal or long-term studies on these sorts of things. So go into the literature and find what was available to demonstrate some of those outcomes.
Okay, thank you. All right, so I just wondered if you were familiar with the Protecting Our Environment by Theory Tomorrow. It's an annual report. Are you familiar with this document?
Yes.
Oh, you have one right there?
Yes.
So I just wanted to take you to page 11. I accept this as it talks about a survey in the Aparema Southern areas, so accept that it's not the white report. I guess the point there is that there were 600 dairy, sheep and beef farmers worked together in that community, which aims to improve the waterways. And in a survey of 151 farmers there showed 80% had farm environment plans, 23% in 2019. The survey found that farmers with environment plans are more likely to implement a broader range of good farming practices. Plans must include actions to reduce farm sediment, nutrient loss, outline how nutrient rules will be implemented, and where riparian planting and fencing is undertaken. And then on the right-hand side there is a blue box there, how farmers are caring for the environment. And are you familiar with that detail there? And so are you able to, just in relation to the 78% leave ungrazed buffers around critical source areas, this involves protecting low-lying parts of farms such as gullies, swales, where runoff accumulates. Can you talk to that, what that means when it talks about ungrazed buffers?
Yes, so this is quite good evidence to show that from an overland flow perspective, attenuation of some contaminants, particularly around sediment, phosphorus bound to that sediment, E. coli to a lesser extent, is mitigated through complexity of flow paths. So what the research shows is that, for example, a rank grass buffer, which is essentially just grass that's left to grow rank, as the name suggests, can attenuate or trap a lot of contaminants. And so what the what that statistic is referring to is managing some of those critical source areas through and through that complexity of flow paths, surface flow paths that are generated through that, for example, rank grass buffer.
Great, thank you very much. And so, can you produce this as an exhibit?
Correct.
Yeah. So, exhibit B, are you going for?
Exhibit 3.
So I just, tell me if this is outside your area of expertise, but I'm just wanting to talk to you about the, under the Resource Management Act, there's been a proposal put to change what's been notified in the plan. There has to be a cost-benefits analysis on that proposed change. And so for the Director General is proposing setbacks of 10 metres from permanent rivers, lakes and wetlands, 3 metres from ephemeral streams, which evidence from the Director General's experts say that most ephemeral streams are critical source areas. Would you agree with that?
It really depends on the context. They can be.
Yes. And so one of the tests under section 32AA is around the risk of acting or the risk of not acting if there's uncertain or insufficient information about, in this case, the setbacks. So are you able to comment on the risk of acting or the risk of not acting in terms of the whether there's any uncertainty around the purpose of setbacks? So does that make sense, my question?
In terms of, I think you call it section 32, so essentially I'm hearing that as a cost benefit. My experience in that space is limited. certainly from a benefit perspective, there is strong evidence to suggest for particularly permanent rural lakes, stock exclusion is important. And as I say, increasing that complexity of flight path is important as well. I think there's probably a broader question that sits under that in terms of the cost associated with that, and I think we've heard over the last week and a half that that's quite a complex dynamic to try and tease that out in terms of where that line sits. So have I done what am I familiar with a cost-benefit analysis in terms of the exclusion from ephemeral waterways? No, I'm not. There will be a balance somewhere in between, and I think that's obviously what the court's process needs to determine.
So in terms of the question, and I probably didn't put it clearly, is that also a test in addition to the cost benefits is around risks of acting. So the risk of, I suppose, is there a risk of, what are the risks you see of not putting those measures in place? What would happen if they didn't have these buffers or exclude stock from these areas? What's the risks arising from that, do you think?
I don't know in terms of quantifying what that might look like.
Well, I mean risk to the environment.
Yep. I think as a general principle, stock exclusion from any waterways, but particularly from the environment waterways, has been looked at.
Right, so is it fair to say your evidence is that there would be risks of not acting if those measures weren't put in place? So if we didn't have, the buffers and the stock exclusions around these water bodies, these ephemerals, which are also critical source areas, what do you see the risk to be to the environment if those measures were not in place?
It depends, it will depend to a fairly significant amount on what's happening in that catchment. The scale, the length of runoff, for example, which is an important factor in determining attenuation and filtering. So the complexities are met, whether there are stock in the locations of some of those smaller waterways at the time of when those ephemeral flow paths are run. So it's broad,
yes.
And can be challenging. In terms of a general principle around stock exclusion, just talking at a high level, stock exclusion is an important component for reducing contaminants to waterways and obviously stock access to banks, to probably habitat and all of those sorts of things.
Okay, so it's not just a matter of assessing whether there's a risk or not, there's a number of other factors to take into account, is that?
I think it is, and that reflects the complexity of the system, and one, and the complexity of landscape and biophysicals, number two. If I bring that right back to, I think, your initial question around, for example, the best practice dairy management, and that advice of having that understanding that conversation on farm, there's in my opinion, a really positive opportunity to understand those at the farm scale and put mitigation options in place that are fit for purpose. And I won't say bespoke, but moving away from a one size fits all approach.
Thank you. And so, have you read the economics? I won't take you there, but basically in the economics joint witness statement, it was agreed that quantifying costs for associated with setbacks, for example, or the cost to farm with having to put setbacks in place was highly uncertain as to what that might be. And so, I just wondered whether, in your role, you were familiar with any funding options available to farmers to assist with fencing and things like area plantings, that sort of thing. Are you familiar with any funding avenues available out there?
Broadly, at arm's length, if you like. I understand that most regional councils offer, for example, subsidies for fencing, subsidies for planting. I know, for example, not fencing but planting, through Farm Source in Ontario, they have a subsidy system, I think it's called Critical Parts for the Trees for it, where farmers, and anyone for that matter, who's got an account, is able to access discount, to get discount prices on the cost of planting, particularly focused on riparian planting.
And so you said anyone, so not just dairy farmers?
Correct. Yeah.
You
just need a Farm Source account.
I see. So, we could just go to your paragraph 5.27. So in here, it talks about the Farm Action Prioritisation Tool, which was developed collaboratively with our Land and Water National Science Challenge and Ag Research. And it's a good example of a tool that can be and is being used to support FEP delivery. And so with this farm app, provides the user with an understanding of water quality in their catchment, an understanding of wider physical factors acting at the farm scale, and based on that, links users to a list of mitigation actions prioritised based on either effectiveness or cost effectiveness. And the tool also links the user with resources and guidance to support practice change and mitigation implementation. Well, have you had any involvement with how that works, or can you speak to that?
Well, I have, not directly. I can't claim to be the brains behind the work, much smarter people doing that. But at a foundational level, what the tool is aiming to do is ensure that farmer can have access to some of the information that, for example, my team does and the expertise in that water quality space. And you'll appreciate that it's a highly complex, you know, understanding mitigation options at the farm scale is highly complex. It's not aimed to be a prescriptive tool in any way, shape, or form. It's not aimed to underpin regulation in any way, shape, or form. But what it's aiming to do is help a farmer and their trusted, particularly their trusted advisor in the first instance, to understand where the farm is. But with that, understand what some of the key biophysical parameters are in terms of risk to wetlands. So your slope, your climate, your rainfall and soil type, that key components of understanding risk to wetlands. So that's the second option. The third, that's the second component. The third component is what the tool does is it places the farm and the landscape and it links through to the latest, to the closest and most relevant water quality monitoring station. And so with that, you're building a layer of knowledge that says, here's my farm, here's what the biophysicals are, here's the water quality, and it will tell you what the water quality sits in the catchment. And based on those things, linking back through the last 50 years' worth of research, the tool will help define a prioritised list of actions. And you appreciate actions. There can be hundreds of actions. As I say, it's not prescriptive, but what it does is it'll bring to the surface some of those actions that are going to be most beneficial based on this work, like climate rain, for example. And positioning in a place that they can inform discussion with a farm advisor. Certifier, if you like, is another option, but in the first instance, that kind of sustainability advisor, those actions can then feed into a farm plan.
And what's the uptake in terms of the use of that tool? Has it been received by the farming community well?
Yeah, so we've been a little bit strategic in terms of how we've rolled that out. Obviously, Lady Pays have funded the research and the effort that's gone into developing that tool.
So who's funded it, sorry?
Oh, Lady Pays, Dairy
Right,
it's So, whilst that's all work across a broader range, a broader landscape, it's been developed primarily for dairy farms, and our approach has been, we think we can get that information in the hands of the greatest number of dairy farms if we go by that intermediate of a dairy company. So, Open Country Dairy is a really good example of where they've taken their farm environment plan, freshwater farm plan, and they've basically built in via a computer language, an API, that their farm plan draws information from that farm app tool and places that directly into the freshwater farm plan.
And I hear that it's open to be used by media payers, if you say?
At this stage, it's a phased approach. Right. So we've got the tool, it's working, and it's really, really beneficial. The Open Country Dairy is a really good example of how that information has been taken up. There is plans afoot to develop that into an open tool that anyone could use.
Excellent, thank you. And just going down to 5.31 of your governance, talks about more capture and innovation and mitigation practices. But what I was interested in is obviously where it talks about treatment of runoff through a constructed wetland. I guess my question there is that would you see constructed wetlands as an alternative to managing runoff, or would it be in addition to other measures?
It's not to fall back on, it depends. And it does depend on other things. A constructed wetland as a tool for treating particularly marshes is very effective. Is that effective for all farms everywhere? The short answer is no. So, to precede that conversation would be the discussion that happens on farm. What are the contaminant or contaminants or ecosystem health issues of most concern? So let's figure that part out as the water catchment context. And let's work backwards from there to figure out what the best mitigation options are. So, if I come back to that Farm Act tool, just as an example, and there are others, right? That's just our approach to addressing this challenge. What that does is, in combination with the discussion that happens with your trusted advisor on farm, your certified, is that, say, we'll talk hypothetically, nitrogen is the issue for my catchment. I've got a soil type and climate and slope and rainfall on these parameters, and of these five most highly prioritised actions, one of them could be, for example, a constructive wetland, and that would then inform that discussion. There could be, other both farm system and vegetable mitigation options to help address that.
Right, it seems to be quite farm specific in terms of real.
that's correct, yeah, that's correct. And if I could give an example, I've got a year or so back from a catchment group that were dead keen on putting in a constructed wetland, large scale. My immediate response to them was, what's the water quality in the catchment where you aim or thinking about putting this? And as it turns out, nitrogen is fine. It wasn't an issue. Notwithstanding constructed wetlands and wetlands more broadly can have other benefits and values, but that they were seeking from a contaminant perspective the best mitigation, and then it's just rewind a little bit and understand what the issue was.
Thank you. Okay, nice there. Just in terms of 6.7 of your documents. You referred to Dr. Scarsbrook's notes that the most effective mitigation must still stop exclusion in some of the ways, improve filtering capacity, provide fewer areas, and continue improving farm dairy effluent management in significant actions to reduce losses in critical resource areas. So it should be noted that all of these actions are considered good farming practices, and dairy farmers are working to ensure they have implemented these practices. In my opinion, this good farming practice approach is relevant for all farmers. Do you want to expand on that?
Yeah, in terms of good farming practice, so we've done, I must say, the dairy sector has done a lot of work in understanding and aiming to hold ourselves to account on what we would expect of every farmer throughout the country. So that work, and I do refer to it in my evidence, aims to provide clarity to farmers, number one. And the second thing that it has aimed to do here is be a bit aspirational. I'm not saying that paragraph 6.7 is aspirational, I'll come back to that in a second. But what it's aiming to do is give a line of sight of what's expected, and with that, allow a farmer to track a path to tick them off. Good farming practices, getting to that level of expected. In their stock exclusion is a key mitigation, and we've heard that over the last week and a half. I don't think there's any dispute around that. So what my note there in 6.7 refers to is just emphasising that, reinforcing that, and understanding that. Come right back to that biophysical context, as well as a good farming practice that's universal. Bring those two things together, that's applicable regardless of pastoral farming type.
Right, thank you. And just in terms of the minimum standards section of your evidence, it's 7.8. We agree with Mr. Brockstock's three key mechanisms that will contribute to ongoing reduction in contaminants. Set minimum standards, all farmers are working towards good farming practices, and including through the use of EPPs and a TED approach, which allows greater scrutiny for high risk farming. So, these set of minimum standards, obviously, you support the stock exclusions. Are there any other minimum standards that you'll
I think Plan Change One does quite a good job of getting the balance right. And so from my perspective, minimum standards that they require, that's 100% clarity. I know what I need to do. I know when I need to do it. And I'll get on and do that. And then layering on top of that good farming practice and the industry initiatives, aspirational, pushing further and further, but giving time frames that are appropriate for implementing those. So when I talked to and agreed with Mr. Brockstock's evidence there, I'm essentially referring to that. So having that layering, which continues it's a continuous improvement cycle, if you like. At the same time as providing crystal clarity on what's expected.
Yes. Thank you. And so, you might not have a view here, but I know you've got an ecological background in terms of experience, although you've also farmed systems, but do you have a view on the appropriate distance of a setback?
At risk of saying it depends, it really does depend. Minimum setback, or at least if I sort of reframe that, any setback of any distance for that matter will depend on the slope, it'll depend on the soil type, it'll depend on the outcomes that are aimed to be achieved, so whether they be a contaminant reduction or whether they aim to be a broader ecosystem. Those two things have a difference, make a difference in terms of what an idea. what I would add to that, I guess, is that as we move into more sort of technology-based and more advanced approaches, precision buffers, for example, are something that a number of research organisations are looking into, such that, again, moving away from a one-size-fits-all approach to thinking about outcomes, and in this example, where that buffer sits relative to the outcome being stored. Yeah.
Thank you. And so, sorry, just one more question. It's in relation to the farm systems conference that you attended. So, just in question one, I'm just interested, the question there, so we've got a copy there. Question one is, do the experts agree E. coli losses are dominated by surface runoff paths because dry stock farms are generally on land greater than 10, 15 or 20 and 20 degrees? Losses are more pronounced from dry stock farms. And so there's a matter of four different points or five different points of agreement. But then under the disagreement section, I see that you are identified as disagreeing with bullet point four in that question, but I couldn't see why that was. Are you able to explain that?
I can, and it's a matter of admission. So I read that question and listened to that question and in haste responded to that question from a proportionality perspective. So in terms of some of the mapping and the modelling that estimates growth across different sectors, I read that question in that sense. And so my response actually related to the proportional contributions of E. coli from different sectors. So it's slightly, I reread that the other day, and it's not quite 100% aligned to that.
To what you understood the question
after. Yeah.
Right, okay. Well, thank you, Mr. Wrightsford, for your evidence. Thank you, Sue.
Thank you.
Now, ruminants, as you just traversed, discusses the farm APT tool, and you've listed a number of different tools. There's the landscape DNA tool, the NRS or nitrogen risk scorecard, the Ravensdown LMC-AG tool, the Balance Ag Research Mitigator tool, and I understand that there are other tools developed around the country, sometimes at a catchment level. You may
know. Probably. I haven't done it. I've limited my assessment there to New Zealand tools.
Okay. Are you aware that the Horizons Regional Council is developing a scorecard tool? And there's the NFE risk tool that's been developed.
I'm aware of that.
And that hasn't been released yet, so I'm not sure if you're able to comment on that at all.
No. I'm aware that it's meant to be released, I think, November, December this year, but at the same time, it was meant to be released November, December last year. We were asked as a technical group whether we wanted to contribute to that. That hasn't happened. Well, I guess what I'm trying to say is that I haven't had much involvement in understanding how that risk assessment tool
So at paragraph 5.9 of your evidence, you talk about this is an example, the loose LUCI air tool, which identifies nutrient hotspots and pathways on spatially detailed maps, allowing for the target of mitigation. What my question was is there's no prescriptive methodology or standardised way of gathering information across these tools which are designed to support FEPs, is there?
I can't comment on the other tools that are mitigated, the LUCI. To be honest, I don't know the details in terms of that spatial data and the extent and quality of data that sits behind those. What I can say in terms of, because I'm more familiar with that Farm Act approach, that sits at a level a lot higher than the individual farm. So that assessment and analysis is done at a national scale based on broader map and understanding of soil type, mapping of climate, rainfall, those sorts of things. So that tool doesn't require a data input, if you like, at the individual farm level. It can provide an output at that individual farm level.
Thank you. And your evidence is not on the use of the tools in a regulatory context. It's more about the using phase. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Mr. Mitchell-Tolk? No. Thank you. Mr. Pearson?
Thank you. Good afternoon. Just a couple of points of clarification. And I know my friend Ms. Tumai took you to paragraph 5.23 of your evidence, and I don't require you to go there, but you were referring there to the system of freshwater farm plans that have been prepared in a certain catchments, and quite a high number of them over a period now, that's correct. And we've also seen in that period still some deterioration in water quality, and I think Dr. Scarsbrook indicated that that could possibly be a result of seasonal variability in matters such as that, and doesn't necessarily reflect adversely on the effectiveness of farm plans. Is that fair?
And I would go broader than that as well. So seasonality, yeah, at a more of a micro scale, at a macro scale, then the complexity of trying to tease out the benefits that come from the farm environment plan and the environment plans at that scale is very, very challenging where you've got a complex catchment that may have native forest, exotic forest, sheep and beef through to areas where it's urban. Like that complexity makes it very, very challenging. So understanding what the background is, understanding how those backgrounds in terms of a water framework quality perspective change, even in a native setting, and some of those do get driven not at a seasonal level but by larger climatic and long-term factors, can make it challenging to tease out the benefits.
Yes. And I think that reflects in part at least the difficulties of looking at individual mechanisms or individual rules, perhaps, or activities in isolation from the other things that are occurring within each sub-catchment. Would it be fair?
Yes. What I would add to that comment, though, is that the increased emphasis and spotlight that's gone on to catchment context, challenges and values, as part of the freshwater regs, is and will help better coordinate, if you like, the actions that take place at a farm scale for the benefit of the catchment system.
Well, in relation to the freshwater farm plans, which obviously Fonterra is very much in favour of, your council, Mr. Minhan, referred in his submissions that we heard earlier to what I might describe as, I mean, we'll talk about intensity change or intensity creep, I might prefer to call it perhaps intensification within limits, possibly, but he talked about the possibility of requiring recertification of final plan in the event that there's a change of, I think he said 5%, but it could be some other figure. So that's something you're comfortable with as a proposition?
I won't comment on that. To be honest, I haven't done a lot of thinking in terms of what that figure looks like.
But that's the position that's been advanced by
the previous.
Now, in that regard, we are having, I mean, whether it's recertified farm plans or farm plans more generally, they're obviously a useful tool for the farmer, and you've talked about the way in which there's a whole advisory wraparound from Fonterra within the industry. But do you agree also that for those plans to have their fullest utility, it's important that plans and recertified plans are provided to the regional council, except that's an important aspect?
I think it's a requirement from the sort of time plan reads,
regardless. But in terms of that, I suppose the purposive nature of that, when that information is received by the regional council, and having regard to those qualifiers you put about what else is going on in the catchment, it would be really important to ensure that when one is carrying out water quality or attribute monitoring and sampling and are seeing trends, that those farm plans provide a useful touchstone to go and look at one possibility of connectivity and reasons for those trends or that tracking, whether it's positive or negative. I'm not suggesting that it's causal, but again, simply having the farm plans sitting there and nobody ever looking at them again when those things are tracking seems to me a lost opportunity. Do you agree with that?
I would agree in the sense that it's important, and I think for sure farm plan reads require anyway, that actions that are in the farm presented to regional council, so tracking that. I would comment at a broader in terms of that cause effect or driver outcome relationship that you're talking about, that is critical, and it would be a shame and I think a lost opportunity not to capitalise on that. What I would say on that, however, is that could be a role for the regional council, but that role will happen regardless. And if I look at the science team that we've got at Dairy NZ and the work that they do, we've got significant FTE dedicated to understanding that. And as the data and information increases, our ability to understand how well that's working will only increase also.
Look, and acknowledge the systems that you have in place around that and come up with those matters. I suppose that it's important, isn't it, do you think, for notwithstanding your efforts and intention, that everybody that is a part of this catchment system also sees and can understand what is occurring in terms of those actions. And what are potential triggers and causes of concern that might need to be addressed on an active and interim basis?
I think so. In the likes of some of our CRIs, National Science Challenges, LM Water has something called a Register of Actions, and at a fundamental level, that's what that principle work aims to do.
And a part is farm plans are one part of the equation only. I suspect that also reflects the position that farm plans aren't simply important for dairy, they're important for dry stock, they're important for CVP. So we need actually to have some commonality of farm plans being provided across this catchment in terms of farming. That's your position.
I agree with that.
Thank you. No further questions. Thank you.
Examination.
I think you already. afternoon, Mr. Rice. I've only got one question, really, and it's, I guess, really efficiency of process. And farm environment plans are obviously a very, very important component of managing the farm. And the regional council will have to look at the effects of those activities on the environment. Is there any way that you would see that farm environment plans could be modified in a way that also looked at effects on the environment more than they do at the moment?
I would probably refer to our good farming practice. It's one of our dairy design practices that I've talked about in my evidence.
Yeah.
And one of those commitments that we've made is that we will monitor and track what we call good farming practice status. And so what I've talked about good farming practice from a sector perspective or an industry perspective being the line in the sand, this is what we expect to provide that clarity as well as provide that aspiration. Right? So we are aiming for continuous improvement. Part of the work that we're doing through there will be to monitor to track into a report on the number of farmers that are meeting good farming practice across the wider farming business. And so as that information flows back, and I'm talking about a dairy example here, but as that information flows back, then that will provide us with that opportunity with a farm plan, for example, and particularly if it was recertified or on a regular basis, to provide that information back at the time that farmer is getting back in touch with their certified. So you can imagine that in a catchment context, a farmer will get their farm plan, that farm plan will be revisited on frequent appearances. As that information on catchment status overall, not just at the farm level, but catchment status and meeting good farming practice is collected, that is an ideal opportunity to feed that information back to the individual farmer via the farm plan after some of that technical analysis has been undertaken. So that's one way that I think could help support in that positive feedback.
It wasn't quite what I had in mind, really. It was looking at, say you've got a high emitting dairy farm, for example, a lot of nitrogen coming out there. Is there any mechanism you could look at in your farm plans to say, in this particular area of the farm, we need to be doing something different because of the likely risk to the environment? Because if that can be done as part of the farm planning process, it could assist in reducing the time the consenting officer would have to spend in looking at that at the consent stage. That's where I'm coming from.
Yeah. And I guess my comment or response to that would be that shines a spotlight on the importance of that certified role and of that role of walking the farm and understanding the contours of soil type, the climate, the farm action that's taking place there, and managing and/or adjusting the pressure.
So it could at least go part way to addressing that issue of effects on the environment from a particular activity or a particular part of the farm.
I think so, and if we come back to the Farm Act example, it's understanding the biophysicals, it's understanding the farm systems, it's understanding the sensitivity of the receiving environment, and it's bringing all of those things together, and at the centre of that, you've got a very nice system for managing at the farm scale of the broader catchment
area. Okay, thank you very much. Thank you.
Thank you. Anything arising?
Thank you very much. Sir, the next witness for Fonterra and Dairy New Zealand is Dr. Dupree.
Thank you.
But one matter, while Mr. Dupree is getting prepared, I did this morning foreshadow the prospect of further narrowing of issues in terms of stock exclusion. Between DairyNZ, Fonterra, Cleveland Lamb and Federated Farmers, there is now an agreed position in relation to stock exclusion. So I did propose to hand up the two pages of those relevant provisions and just briefly talk you through those, just so that if there are questions of either Dr. McGree or Mr. Willis, they can be directed in relation to the updated state of the world.
Yes, please.
Yes, I was just going to orientate the court and parties. There have been a number of different versions of these provisions, and so we've tried to avoid a 17-page long version of them. So we have essentially the track is consolidated track on the decision version.
Yes.
And so if we just go clause by clause through, so in terms of subclause 1, or clause 1, those changes shown in the track are the same as the council conferencing version. You'll recall, though, that the council conferencing version then had a quite detailed different options with certification using certain standards. So we haven't shown all of that, but we've removed that detail, and I'll come on to clause 5, which is the key aspect that deals with those parameters. Then in relation to clause 2, the changes shown to A and B are consistent with the council post-conferencing version. The changes to clauses 2C and D, those are matters that my friend for Beef and Lamb and Federated Farmers has been advancing. Fonterra and Dairy New Zealand don't take a position in relation to those changes, but we've included them with the list so that the court has all on one page those provisions. Clause, and so those relate to, in particular, some of those questions around step-back distances, whether there are averages, and I'm sure Mr. Matheson will take you through those tomorrow, presumably. Clause 3 is the same as the council post-conferencing version.
Yes.
Clause 4 is different to the council version, so this goes to the timing requirement, and so that is consistent with the position that that all of the agricultural interests have pursued through their provisions that have been circulated. And so it's really clause 5 that I just wanted to explain in particular as far as the three components to that. So 5A relates to situations where there is intensive grazing occurring. Clause B relates to water bodies where there is a slope less than 10 degrees. And so the requirement is for an A and B permanently or intermittently flowing rivers, etc. And then in relation to clause 5C, this is for land with a slope of greater than 10 degrees. And so the requirement is, there's a lot of drafting there, but it is essentially permanent water bodies greater than 1 metre in width are required to have stock exclusion. and then intermittent water bodies of greater than 1 metre in width are required to be excluded unless they are certified as not being practicable. And where that's the case, there are then measures proposed to achieve the outcomes set out in policy 2B here. But you have heard from Federated Farmers and Bedford Lamb on that issue. Then at the end of clause 5, we have sought to build in the use of the MFE slope map, with also building in the potential for a replacement for that, LIDAR has been referred to, as well as the ground truthing potential as well. And then the rest of the track shown in those exclusions are the same as the council post-conference inversion. And so the certainly from my client's perspective, this reflects a way of addressing some of the concerns that our client had with the council post-conferencing version, but at the same time recognising the costs, practicalities and those sort of challenges that there has also been a fair degree of evidence and discussion on during the course of the hearing to date.
Just remind me who supported
this. Certainly, so Fonterra, Dairy New Zealand, Federated Farmers and Beef and Lamb. Back to you if it's anything different to that, but I would have expected that that is just as defined. Thank you. So we'll now turn to Dr. Dupree. Dr. Free.
Good afternoon.
So do you confirm your full name is Craig Verdon Dupree?
Yes.
And you're a Principal Water Quality Scientist at Dairy New Zealand?
Yes.
And you've prepared 2 statements of evidence dated 28 July and 11 August 2023?
That's correct.
And you have the qualifications and experience set out in your primary evidence?
Yes.
And you also contributed to the Water Quality Joint Witness Statement through conferencing on 4 and 5 September.
That's correct.
Now, in terms of corrections to your statement, understand there are some corrections to be made and we have prepared a memorandum of counsel addressing those changes. Do you have a copy of that?
I did, but I buried it in my vast piles of papers. Sorry.
So a copy of this has been provided. Has been provided to the parties, and so there are a number of changes. So, in the interest of time, I wonder if the witness can confirm those by reference to the memorandum without going through each of them individually.
You've reviewed this, Dr.
Yes, I have.
And you're satisfied that this accurately sets out the amendments that you wish to make?
Yes, it does.
Thank you.
Thank you. So subject to those corrections, do you confirm that the statements of evidence are true and correct to the best of your knowledge and belief?
Yes.
Thank you. Before I hand you over for questioning, Commissioner Hodges earlier asked some questions of Mr. Allen in relation to the Abacus Bio report in relation to the nitrogen risk scorecard. Are you, were you here for that questioning?
Yes, I was here.
And following that, you've had the chance to look at that Abacus Bio report?
Yes, over lunch.
I just wonder, to assist the court, are you just able to provide any comments from your perspective in relation to what you've taken from that Abacus Bio report? Take the time that you'd like.
Firstly, there are any sort of more detailed questions that can be referred, I guess, to Matthew Brown or Fonterra. But and from what I took from this, it's the data set of farms from the 2016-17 year, where they had the all the various components that go into the nitrogen risk scorecard, and then they've been using those various components or the inputs into the nitrogen risk scorecard to then sort of look at a model using 75% of that data as training data to sort of build these models that then tries to correct two things from Overseer, and that's the nitrogen loss and then not the purchased end surplus but the nitrogen surplus from Overseer as well, which includes fixation. And so I think to your point about irrigation, so they sort of divided the data into, they sort of looked at all farms, non-irrigated farms and irrigated farms, with irrigated farms being a relatively sort of small data set out of the, how many farms was it? I think it was something like about sort of 5,500 farms, and 4,900 they used in the training data set. I think in terms of irrigated farms, it was about sort of 500 they had. So from my understanding, from my lunchtime report, I was eating sausage roll, it was in terms of, and we all know that the nitrogen risk scorecard is looking at risk outside of the soil and the climate. And so in terms of the predictions, you might expect then a better prediction of the Overseer surplus, and then also predicting in what the Overseer end loss would be. And so pretty much across all farms, the irrigated farms, the non-irrigated farms, it was basically around that sort of 40 to 45% R squared, the predicted relationship from that those models could predict the Overseer end loss, and then the prediction for the Overseer surplus was about sort of 85 to 90%. And then they also looked at, of those regressions, what was the most important factors, I guess, from the nitrogen risk scorecard that was accounting for those relationships. And I think and it didn't seem to make much difference between irrigated and non-irrigated. By far the most important factor that accounted for most of the variation that nitrogen applied, or generally accounted for 50% of the variation. And then I think for the end surplus model, where you sort of had that 90% sort of prediction, the other important one that accounted, the secondary, or the second most sort of important one was, the equivalent distance or something. Equivalent discharge destination was the one for, that was the secondary important one for the Overseer surplus models. And I guess one of the important things too is when they use 75% of the data, so about sort of 5,000 farms to build the models, and they use 25% of them to predict those, and that gave similar, very similar numbers again, that sort of 40 to 45 and 85 to 90% prediction for the end loss and the end surplus predictions. And I think, and because of that particular test they were doing, because when you're looking at, say for example, PC1, we might have 80% of farm data and we're thinking about the 20% page 21 of that report, the last sentence actually on that page, and it says, from, in, that, in terms of that particular process, when they're talking about the transport, how transportable these would be, it said, this indicates the model is transportable across data sets and does provide consistent prediction of the voter CAN loss and of the CAN surplus from N scorecard subfactors. So,
where is that on the page?
Oh, sorry, that's the last sentence on page.
Oh, right, the model on the page.
Yeah,
306.0065.
Yes,
is the final reference.
So you've got that. So, like I say, as expected, from a prediction, from an in-risk system, like in risk scorecard, which is those things that are controllable to the farmer, that's why it's not including some of those sort of climate and soil ones, and that's why it's, I guess, a 40-45% squared when predicting the end loss, you know, because these those components that the much in risk scorecard is not taking into account. But in terms of that, obviously, end surplus, you know, like I say, it's very good. And then I guess the one figure on page 23, that figure 16, I guess shows that there's still a, well, there's a bit of difference between those, that there's still a strong correlation between that sort of end loss and end surplus. That's a 70, let's say that's a 73% sort of relationship. So I guess, you know, there's these, I guess, well, from my perspective anyway, of having a lunchtime read, it's sort of, you can at least sort of infer that I think there's some certainty through those relationships that if there's a, you know, on average, if there's an increase in overseer, or in overseer end loss, and there must be, on average, there must be an increase from those relationships in the March and the scorecard. So that was a very brief synopsis from a lunchtime read of a report that I've seen before, so hopefully that was. If there's any other questions, I guess we do.
Well, N applied, nitrogen applied,
yep.
That essentially fertilizer.
Yes.
Would there be much else that would go into nitrogen applied?
You mean in terms of that?
In terms of over 50% of the explained variance in both N loss and N surplus models is accounted for by nitrogen applied in kilograms per hectare.
Oh, so you mean is that specifically synthetic N fertilizer applied? Because, yeah, that's also no good question, and I can't answer that one, unfortunately, because I was just reading the term. So if anyone knows the N applied term, so what?
Evidence by consensus.
I tried to just sort of have a look at this report and give a brief summary that may or may not have been helpful, may or may not have answered your questions, but that was.
I think that the questions that I had are probably go into a lot more detail. I don't think that's going to help us.
Yes.
The bottom line for me, we're interested in is, from what you've read, do you think using both of them as a gateway or consent, do you think there's too much variability to say that a consent, a gateway using overseer and a gateway using the risk scorecard could be too far apart to enable them to be used in both used to be used in PC1.
Yeah, so I think there's an analysis that would probably have to be done to provide you with that certainty. I mean, if we've got, if there's from 1 year a data set, a nitrogen risk scorecard data set, then there's that equivalent year when they did, I think there is an equivalent year if they had the NLR, whatever it's called, the overseer loss. Then you've got however many, it wasn't the Waikato or in that field, however many dairy farms, then you must be able to sort of put those farms into their respective bins on both those gateways, and then actually look at the percentage similarity of what's in those bins. And that's what you're kind of asking. I think that's what you're asking. something that we'd have to put to Mr. Allen about the availability of that data to do that analysis to provide that. But I don't think anyone's done it yet, but that's what I would really do it to sort of shine a light on that.
I think from my point of view, that's about as far as we can take it for the moment. Thank you.
But what that would entail, presumably, would be the need to unpack what is behind the NRS or the NLLR components. Because the concern, as I understand it, as it's been raised or put to Mr. Allen, is that because the two methods bring in different considerations, you can have marginal differences, potentially quite significant marginal differences in different farm situations.
And yes, I don't want to go further outside my lane, I should, but I still would have thought of this as a first cut. You wouldn't have to unpack anything to initially look at the composition of the bins through those two drafting gates.
I think that's ultimately the judgment question.
Yes.
In the face of people saying you produced a number, therefore that must be it. But for example, figure 16, the dotted line might be what somebody refers to as the output, but in fact there are however many dots there are, and it's the dots that are the actual evidence, not the dotted line, in terms of the data.
Absolutely. Yes, sir.
And I mean, there's been the suggestion of things like an error factor in relation to that, but actually those dots are not errors. Those dots are the evidence. The question is making sense of that evidence by identifying a trend line.
Yes, that's right, and that's what you're saying, that at least you just say on average, you know, sort of
exactly.
In terms of, but then the, and I think that's some of the point that Mr. Willis has made in evidence about, you can have an R squared value that looks okay, but then you can have individual farms of where it could be, not quite 50% or something like that,
right.
or not higher.
Statistics and then lies and then damn right.
Yes.
All right. Thank you very much for that explanation.
Thank you. Please answer any questions from my friends and the court.
Comments?
Thank you, Your Honour. Good afternoon, Dr. Pritt.
Good afternoon.
Now, I've just got a couple of areas I just wanted to discuss with you. One is around stock exclusion. And I'm looking at paragraph 6.12 of New Reference and Sheep. We've got that handy. Got that in front of you there?
Yes, I assume I was very quick.
I was going to take you through it. So
okay.
That's fine. So you said here, in my opinion, stock exclusion, preferably in conjunction with riparian restoration and planting, is one of the most important mitigating actions for protecting and improving waterways and pastoral catchments. Benefits are greatest when applied to as much of the catchment as possible, including smaller headwater streams. Weaker stock exclusion standards that reduce the spatial extent and hence the length of stream network protected from the well-documented, I guess, negative impacts of stock excess will result in poorer ecosystem health and human health outcomes for PC1 streams. Does that remain your professional opinion?
Yes, and the documented was in the corrections as far as
that. No, that's fine, thank you. I didn't pick that up when I transferred them across. Thank you. Stepping now down to 6.13, you talk here about the different mapping, and I just want to make sure I've got a good understanding of the MFE 15 metre digital elevation model. Does the 15 metre component relate to data points that are 15 metres apart when measured on land essentially?
Yes, that's my understanding, yeah.
So it's about the granularity of the model and how accurate it is to map actual rolling.
Yes. And so like LIDAR, which people have raised, is I think 1 metre.
Yes. So LIDAR would be more accurate than the 15 metre so you or DairyNZ have endeavoured to extrapolate the MFE data to show that from the 10 degree low slope map and a 15 degree low slope map, but that would suffer from the same underlying data source restrictions in terms of the fact that it's still based on that 15 metre plot, isn't it?
The intent was just to use, we got that from MFE, the 15 metre DEM, because we were trying to do some analysis just to find out about 15 degrees. And that was when some of those other models, like the LENZ or the LENS, which was one of the original MFE, MFE slope paths that got quite critiqued. So that, and we found the same issues with this too much averaging. And so to sort of try and produce something that was consistent, so when we sort of tried to compare how much was between 10 and 15, the change was going to be from 15 to 10, and so that was why we intended to try and reproduce the Manaaki Whenua map that was made for MFE that had that 0 to 5 low slope and the 5 to 10 median slope. So I guess we tried to then reproduce those and then insert in that 10 to 15 degree slope.
Yes, and you've shown in your evidence at appendix 1 the map at a whole read or a catchment scale. Do I take it that map you could have it in a GIS system, zoom in a whole lot further and see on someone's individual land subject to the limitations of the free data?
Yes, you could, yes.
I was going to say, otherwise it's very challenging to look at that map and work out where you might be on it, but if you can zoom in, that's helpful. And in terms of the approach that's taken for this plan change, as you've indicated in paragraph 611, the decisions version used a stock exclusion slope of 15 degrees, and that was supported by DNZ and Fonterra. Do I take it you were in support of that?
The 15 degrees? Yes.
Yes,
because and that's consistent with 612. I think, to get maximum benefits of something, from a technical perspective, this is not from a necessarily always a practical perspective to scientists. So if there's a mitigation that's going to have been useful in terms of intersecting or beneficial in terms of reducing those four contaminants, then obviously on pastoral land, that the greater number of types of streams and the extent of land you apply those mitigations to, then obviously you get greater benefits accruing.
Yes, that's right. So your evidence here is really responding to that and saying, well, from a water quality perspective, you've got less comfort reducing it down to a 10 degree, as Mr. Bilko proposed.
Yes, oh, and especially because it was just that less comfort is to what it was just limited around the map, so that you could whether it was possible to sort of produce a map that would then enable that limitation to be addressed.
Yes, that's right. And so you've taken a bit of a problem solving approach to it and try and help reduce that map, didn't you?
Yes.
And then likewise, you've talked about LIDAR. If mapping using LIDAR was available, that would be preferable again, and then ground truthing would be available, and that's useful as well.
Yes, I'm not sure as to how much more accurate, LIDAR makes it more accurate. I think one of the challenging ones, and one of the limitations of the 15 of the maps that we produce, is that one of the things that makes it, I think, most workable for landowners is you've actually got to smooth them out. You get a very pixelated, once you get little 10 to 15 degree pieces, so we'll get quite pixelated, and there'll be little islands of this. And so what's happened with the MFE maps is that they've actually smoothed all the contours to make it actually follow, I guess, a bit more like a contour map, than sort of things. You've got smooth running contours, so a farmer can look at that, or a landowner can look at that. And that's something that we haven't done yet. We just did it for the sake of time. So, for example, I've looked at one of the farms, Federated Farms, that did an analysis it might have been Mr. Berry's farm. And so we got the same, but we were using 15 degrees, and we had algorithm more pixelated, but we sort of have got the map, we put our layers up on his farm as well. But we actually got one hectare less land, even though we were going to 15 degrees. You know, so that's just that. Because the smoothing from the UFBs actually does take in a little bit more. We'll probably take in some stuff that's greater than 10 degrees. So yeah, so the point being is that there's some smoothing nuances in the maps that actually sort of make them workable as opposed to heaps and heaps of resolution.
Okay, thank you, that's helpful. Now, one of the other things you covered in your evidence is thin alternatives to fencing, and you've talked about some of these. It's around paragraph 6.32 where you talk about studies. Study by Bagshaw that found that where water troughs were located upslope, they were not effective in keeping cattle out of the stream. In similar studies elsewhere that showed cattle may prefer to stay within the riparian area where surrounding land is steeper, irrespective of forage quality and cattle age. And I guess what I wanted to explore is the potential that in the toolbox that a farmer might have, these other mechanisms could be useful in addition to fencing, in light of the overall goal of keeping stock away from water bodies where possible. You've expressed concern in 6.34 in particular about whether those other types of mechanisms, other than physical stock exclusion, will achieve the benefits of stock exclusion. That's really where you land on that. You're not sure that it's going to achieve all of the benefits.
Absolutely. I strongly believe that they won't.
And
they may help. They may help if it's in terms of those comments are in relation to, I guess, whether it can achieve what can be achieved with a fence. You know, if you're actually going to physically exclude stock, and so that those comments are, I don't think it can achieve what excluding stock with a fence can achieve. I'm not saying that they won't reduce it, but if the idea is, we know even from, especially with E. coli, for example, the NEWA, you know, published work on even a couple of animals going into a small stream with low dilution will result in exceedance of E. coli. So that's it. I don't know if to get maximum benefits, full exclusion is guaranteed with a fence, the right fence, I guess, in the right place. So again, it's from a technical perspective that I was, or a scientific perspective, I'm saying that it's like, if you want to get maximum benefits of stock exclusion, then you can physically exclude the stock from it, as opposed to something that might give you a 10% reduction or 40% or even 60% reduction. But what if that 40% access is still not actually resulting in is still, I don't know whether it's linear, you know, in terms of the impact, especially if it was like breaking banks or something like that. So that's sort of the context, like it's still not comments, not those other efforts pointless and don't work at all. Although I guess my main concern is that even on some of that literature, those off-stream watering tend to work better on low slopes, and a lot of the studies that apply that in Milan reference that I put in the review, 37 studies, it stated that there was generally more success, I think, with on low slopes, and they used 10% as an example, so that's only 5 degrees, and so then it was less effective as you went to higher slopes. And so if we're looking for these, if we're talking 10 degrees, 15 degree slopes, I think the literature is even, well, the evidence base is even more tenuous when you go to higher slopes, steeper slopes.
So it is very much situation specific as to what might work.
I don't think anything's going to work as good as things anywhere on any slope.
Yeah, so there's a difference really between encouraging the stock into one location versus preventing them from going into the other location. That's the difference.
Yes.
Putting Paw Patrol on the TV is going to keep my 2-year-old near the TV, but it won't guarantee he doesn't go and wreck the other room.
That's a reasonable analogy.
But in terms of tools in a toolbox, would you agree it's helpful to have a plan that enables a practical on-site assessment to work out what's most useful in the situation. It's certainly better to have those tools than to not, from a farming perspective, isn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, you can't have a fence or rubber or shade trees and off stream water, at least.
Yes. So the fence will be more effective, but it's hard to know. It's not possible to say that those other measures will be ineffective in some way.
Oh no, I don't think they could potentially be ineffective, but I can say with pretty high certainty that they will not be as effective as a fence.
Thank you very much, Doctor.